bans. Recently, he warned the Zionist regime it cannot survive if it becomes a global pariah. Schumer accused Netanyahu of putting political survival above national interest and said he had been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for the Zionist regime worldwide to historic lows. Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah, he said. The loss of public opinion in the West, the continuing genocide case at the International Court of Justice, the erosion of Jewish consensus, and the nervousness of the Zionist regime's backers, all of these elements point to a strategic defeat for the child killer regime of Israel. Even if the war stops now, the price the Israeli regime has paid for the reoccupation of Gaza will be higher than it could have possibly calculated 5 months ago, but it has yet to realize this. It will.
يعني
بازار
Whether man-made or not, food can have fascinating backstories. Products usually take a long journey before they end up on the dining table. Nevertheless, the food industry follows several golden rules that have helped it steadily grow over time. The most important of these is continuous product innovation and improved production processes to reduce costs and wastage. Others involve packaging and product accessibility, but probably the king of all rules is the taste that drives the food industry.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will be exploring the food industry and its related agricultural markets. We wanted to see how the food sector has expanded over the years and what companies are doing to increase their profits. So let's check out the Tasty Grub.
To become more familiar with how much work goes into food production, we visited Golha Food Industries. It was established nearly a century ago, and its products are now a household name. It produces hundreds of items in seven categories, such as dried legumes and fruits, spices and canned products. It also takes great pride in its healthy product line, including gluten-free flour products. This producer has devoted a lot of attention to the packaging of its products. Due to its diverse product list, it purchases such materials as cans, plastic, and cardboard to design the appropriate type of storage systems for distribution. The company has a massive daily output due to its expansive production facilities. Most of the work is done by automated machines, but the fine details are handled by experienced staff. All production processes start when raw material enters the company. These materials are first tested for quality before hitting the production floors, most of which are domestically supplied. After being tested, the material is sent to various closed circuit machines for processing. Then it is time for sorting and more quality control tests before packaging.
Food production is a very sensitive process requiring many checks and controls that guarantee the final product is safe for consumption. And production machines play an essential role as they reduce errors and maintain constant output results. Plus, many of these machines have been domestically engineered, whereas they were previously imported at high prices.
This company has a highly equipped quality control and research and development lab. It's where many new products are created and food safety standards are controlled. Moreover, the staff in this department implement food sciences to make innovative products. It might be interesting to know that this department also has some of the best food tasters. This producer has been awarded Best Research and Development Department in Food Production for many consecutive years. Among its many achievements, it has also been awarded the certificate of favored brand by customers. This wouldn't be possible without adhering to strict national and international food safety and production management standards. Following such standards has helped it maintain its export share in the global food market. With years of experience, this company has grown such that it provides thousands of employment opportunities, both directly and indirectly. It also has thousands of agencies and stores all over the country. Plus, its products can also be purchased online. As part of its future vision, this company is looking to increase its market share both domestically and abroad. It also has long-term plans to increase production and improve the production process for efficiency.
The Iranian food industry has taken giant strides away from its traditional production methods. Industry participants say using food sciences and new technologies has helped the food industry grow faster than before. Never more than now has food been more accessible. In fact, it only requires a touch of a few buttons to receive it at home. Therefore, food packaging is a critical part of the production.
Over the last decade, there has been a great emphasis on developing packaging for the food industry. This is because Iran indigenized many machines needed to process and produce food items such as deli meats, beverages, pickles, and so much more. Proper packaging also increases shelf life, which is important for consumers. Previously, food items such as spices and dairy products were purchased bulk from customers abroad due to a lack of packaging. While exporting items in bulk has benefits, it's not as profitable as selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions. Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions, worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences. We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out. Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Well, I believe it is that time of the show where I should take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Despite all the advancements in technology and the problems it has solved, food security is one it hasn't. In fact, it is becoming more and more of an issue beyond the countries that have always been grappling with it. One solution is to, well, end inflation and the global economic crisis, but that's hardly a solution. There's no end in sight with that. But another way is to use technology to make things more efficient. We wouldn't be needing more land because we're not getting it thanks to desertification of more and more land. We also wouldn't be needing more water because we're also not getting it, also thanks to desertification. We would actually need less of both if only we could manage our resources better.
Iran has some potential for farming and agriculture, and that's a massive understatement if you've ever heard one. But we could definitely do with some improvements, some innovations in the field, especially with irrigation, because, well, we've been experiencing some drought and some water shortages a little bit more than what climate change would warrant. And that's why we're here to check out a smart greenhouse that believes has the answer, the shakeup that the industry needs to be a lot more efficient, especially with water, plus some extra goodies. So stay tuned to this episode of The Bazaar to check out what they've been able to come up with.
About that efficiency, greenhouses can help provide that by creating a controlled environment that, while it could be much smaller than a field, it can yield higher quality produce and more produce per acre. Greenhouses can protect the crops and vegetables from extreme weather conditions, pests, or really any other external threat. The parameters that are controlled in a greenhouse are light, ventilation, humidity, and temperature. This would allow the farmers to create the kind of optimal micro-ecosystem that would eventually lead to them growing healthier, tastier, more nutritious, and, you know, better-looking produce.
What you will find in this smart greenhouse are tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, bell pepper, and cucumbers. There are certain types of fruits and vegetables that are preferred to be used in greenhouses, for example, the ones that I just mentioned. And there are certain types of crops that are not optimal for greenhouse use, for example, wheat and rice. But that's just some information about greenhouses in general. What makes this particular greenhouse unique and smart is that all of the parameters that need to be kept in check in a greenhouse are all monitored and manipulated remotely through the cloud and Internet of Things, instead of some worker or some farmers coming in and out of the greenhouse to manipulate things manually. That's the smart aspect of it in a nutshell. But to find out more information about the smartness of this greenhouse, let's hear from some of the experts here.
In this greenhouse, we measure all essential parameters for the plants, like temperature, moisture, CO2, ambient light, the water parameters, and the moisture of the roots, using the available sensors, and control them with the actuators and the smart control unit, and also remotely control it via Internet of Things. With properly controlling the climate and the irrigation system, we increase the productivity up to 30% and decrease the water consumption by up to 40% comparing other hydroponic greenhouses in our country. And in the next step, we are trying to recycle the drained water of the irrigation system and pass it through some filters and put it back again into the irrigation system in order to further decrease the water consumption. And also, we are developing a robotic harvester, including a mobile-based manipulator, soft gripper, and vision system equipped with artificial intelligent algorithm in order to detect the ripe crops and pick them in the proper time.
1% of the world's water resources are fresh water, and most of it, in fact, 70% of it, is used in agriculture. What we choose to do with that tiny, finite reserve is a responsibility that we need to bear. Greenhouses can control the irrigation of plants. You may have sophisticated plumbing systems in the ground or in the cocoa peats, as you will see, to prevent overwatering, which can promote rots and fungal diseases, and reduce evaporation, saving huge amounts of water in the process. There is even the option to recycle the runoff water and put it back into the system to further save up on water. The great thing about this particular smart greenhouse is that you don't need to be born into a farmer family that has thousands of acres of land to make this a viable option to you. You can own land as small as 100 square meters and it would still be a financially viable option for you. Especially since after the initial installation phase and the setup process, you won't be needing much manpower to control the environment.
Interest has been shown in this smart greenhouse by certain countries, especially in Africa, such as Kenya, Niger, and Ethiopia. The idea, and of course the working proof of the idea, really has the potential to shake up the industry. And if it catches on, it can only mean good things for the farmers and the food sector in general. Thank you for staying tuned to another episode of Bazaar.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
in the limelight.
Between border visits and rallies, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are dueling to control the narrative on immigration, placing the issue and Mexico's role in it at the heart of the upcoming election. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Florida's governor signed bills on Friday, 15th of March, that increased the prison and jail sentences for immigrants who are living in the United States illegally if they're convicted of driving without a license or committing felonies. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is a frequent critic of the Biden administration over its handling of the Mexican border, sending Florida law enforcement agents and National Guard members to Texas. The Republican governor of Florida, who ended his attempt for his party's presidential nomination recently, has also flown immigrants who entered Texas illegally to Massachusetts and to California. Ron DeSantis said, "We do not tolerate illegal immigration, let alone lawlessness committed by illegal aliens who shouldn't be here in the first place." The bills I signed on Friday further enhance Florida's capabilities to uphold the law. The driver's license bill increases the maximum sentence for anyone convicted of driving without a license twice or more from 60 days in jail to a year. This also applies to U.S. citizens and immigrants in the country illegally. But in Florida, undocumented people are barred from obtaining a driving license in the first place. Some immigrant support groups have criticized the bill, saying it endangers the public safety, as many immigrants are barred from getting a driving license will still drive. They just won't have been tested or buy driving insurance. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 19 states and Washington, D.C. issue driver's licenses to immigrants who are in the country illegally. Renata Bozzetto of the Florida Immigrant Coalition said in a recent statement, "True safety is achieved through comprehensive measures such as driver education, issuing driver's licenses to all qualified drivers, and access to insurance, not through punitive enforcement." Bozzetto added, "Rather than criminalizing individuals, the Republican legislature in Florida should work to invest in initiatives that promote driver safety, address disparities in the licensing process, and ensure equitable access to transportation for all residents." Another bill increases the maximum prison sentences for immigrants who are convicted of felonies after having been previously deported from the country for illegal entry. For example, such immigrants convicted of low-level felonies like simple burglary or car theft would face a maximum sentence of 15 years in prison instead of the 5-year sentence that is the crime's normal maximum. Such immigrants convicted of mid-level felonies like aggravated battery would face a maximum sentence of 30 years instead of the 15-year sentence that is those crimes' normal maximum. And higher-level felonies like armed robbery could now carry a life sentence for such immigrants instead of the normal maximum sentence of 30 years imprisonment. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Between border visits and rallies, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are dueling to control the narrative on immigration, placing the issue and Mexico's role in it at the heart of the upcoming general election. In tasking Mexico with reducing arrivals at the border, the United States has given its neighbor leverage over U.S. political discussion. Underground, this has meant many migrants find themselves stuck in Mexico, running a gauntlet of extortion and violence as they try to make it to the other side of the border, to the United States. Ari Sawyer, a researcher at Human Rights Watch, said it used to be that the Darien Gap was the most horrific part of their journey, but now people are saying that Mexico is the worst, adding that Mexico is the new jungle. There are two components to Mexico's central role in U.S. immigration. Many Mexicans are themselves going to the United States, and Mexico remains the top nationality among immigrants. Then there is Mexico's status as the United States' immigration enforcer, a role that has evolved over the course of Andrés Manuel López Obrador's presidency, starting in 2018, as the number of migrants trying to reach the United States through Mexico has risen tremendously. Compared to before the pandemic, detentions of migrants in an irregular situation have risen fourfold, reaching almost 800,000 cases in 2023. According to Tonatiuh Guin, former commissioner of Mexico's National Institute of Migration, detained people should be taken for a migration office to be reviewed. Meanwhile, consulates should be contacted and the decision made on as to whether to repatriate them. But he says if the official detention numbers are accurate, then it would be far beyond the capacity of Mexico's institutions to process them. In any case, deportations have not risen in step with detentions. On the contrary, they collapsed last year to a little over 50,000 cases. In the first year of López Obrador's administration, deportations as a percentage of detention stood at 88%. In 2023, they stood at 6.8%. What is happening instead, according to human rights organizations, is that migrants are being put on buses and sent back south, sometimes all the way to the border with Guatemala. Rafael Velasquez, Mexico's director of the International Rescue Committee, said, if you're detained in Mexico City, you go to Acayucan. If you're detained in Acayucan, it's Villahermosa. And if you're detained in Villahermosa, it's Palenque. Adding, in other words, you go one step back.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لَا يُقِيمُ أَمْرَ اللَّهِ سُبْحَانَهُ إِلَّا مَنْ لَا يُصَانِعَ وَلَا يُضَارِعَ وَلَا يَتَّبِعُ الْمَطَامِعَ.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam. So, dear friends, again, we are in the holy month of Ramadan, this beautiful month, with some trials and some difficulties and some hardships. But a month which, very humbly, I believe, that anybody who is not able to witness this holy month is very, I guess, envious of those who are able to witness this holy month, and to be able to fulfill the rights and responsibilities and duties that we are capable of in this holy month of Ramadan. So we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We find, of course, that one of the traits and characteristics of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this idea that he was an individual who was smiling. His face was very soft, approachable, if you will. And these are things that we find, you know, historically, and extrapolate based upon the various traditions that we find in which the imams talk about having a cheerful face and smiling. So these are kind of things that are important. Sometimes we think that the imams were always frowning, or they had this mean face and they were walking around town, you know, with their eyebrows scrunched, when the reality is very different. These were individuals that they were so beautiful, and their faces were so illuminated that they would glow while they walked in the streets, and they were approachable, and their faces were soft. They weren't hard like tyrants or oppressors or criminals or, you know, gangsters and thugs and these kind of people. We find they had very soft faces and they were very approachable. People wanted to come and speak to them. People wanted to know who these individuals were. So that's one aspect we find of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And it's interesting that he talks about this even in his various statements. He says that cheerfulness is on the believer's face. You can see that the believer is very serene, tranquil, at peace. And this is something that I think is really important, even though there's other characteristics that I wanted to talk about, but, you know, I'm kind of running out of time. So I guess we'll just stop at this idea here. You know, many times, yes, we have problems in our lives. We have difficulties. You know, we're dealing with a lot of stuff on a daily basis. But that should never prevent us from carrying ourselves in a serene manner, in a tranquil, peaceful manner, in a cheerful manner, you know? Sometimes we're so caught up in our own lives that we forget that perhaps other people have problems as well. I mean, we forget that maybe other people are suffering, other people are sad. And so when you realize that perhaps other people are sad as well, and this is where the point comes into play, when you are cheerful, despite having your own problems, when you smile at others, despite having your own problems, you bring happiness to another individual who is most probably also facing trials and difficulties and hardships and is also sad. So you bring them happiness, and in return, what will happen? They will smile back at you, they will be cheerful, and they will bring you happiness as well. Just one last point, even though we're probably out of time, and that's that being cheerful and being happy does not mean being kind of crazy and exhilarated and, you know, laughing out loud. And a very serene, peaceful, calm cheerfulness is what is being said. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma fastajib du'ayi واقبل ثناي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائك بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
And now we invite you to listen to Fayyaz Ja'far.
This is why Allama Majlisi in Bahar al-Anwar, he states that submission or ma'rifa of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt is that tomorrow, for instance, that if Imam Sahib al-Zaman, he comes into this masjid, and he stands in front of every single one of us, and he tells you, look at this apple. The right side of the apple is halal, and the left side of the apple is haram. That it's the responsibility of every single one of us to submit toward it unconditionally. Don't say, but how is the right side halal and the other side haram when they're part of one dimension in its entirety? No. Ma'rifa, absolute knowledge of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wasalam, is to submit unconditionally, that if the Imam tells you, put your sword away, you put your sword away. That this side of the apple is halal and the other side is haram, that's it, it's finished. And what made Malik al-Ashtar the recipient of such divine knowledge from Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, was this love, was this loyalty, was recognizing the wilaya of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen in all of its unique capacities. The historians, they write that when Imam Ali alayhi salam is now the governor, or he's the fourth caliph, and he establishes his government in the holy city of Kufa, his first governor of Egypt was his adopted son, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr. But due to the onslaught of Muawiyah from Damascus and his attempts toward overtaking the region of Egypt where Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr ruled, Imam Ali alayhi salam thought that he would make a strategic move toward placing Malik al-Ashtar, who was really smart,
who was really chivalrous, who had a lot of bravery. But most importantly, he had a large army ready behind him to protect Egypt from any sort of onslaught from Muawiyah. So he writes a letter toward Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, relieving him of his duty. And then he goes toward sending Malik al-Ashtar toward Egypt so that he's able to take over the governorship of that region of his caliphate. What happened was that Malik al-Ashtar, on his way toward going toward Egypt, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam writes toward him this famous letter, letter 52 or letter 53 of Nahj al-Balagha, that many of us are obviously very familiar with. Malik al-Ashtar takes the letter, he goes toward Egypt, and when news began to spread in Damascus that Malik al-Ashtar is going to become the governor of Egypt, and at the same time he's going to bring forth his large army contingency, Muawiyah began to have a little bit of fear. So Amr ibn al-As goes toward Muawiyah. Of course, Amr ibn al-As, the close confidant of Muawiyah. He goes toward him and he says, hey, if we allow for Malik al-Ashtar to go toward establishing the governorship of Egypt, we're going to be in trouble. So they create a ploy, they make a system that on the journey between Kufa and Egypt, many people back in the day, they take a lot of rest stops, right? Like today, for instance, if I'm driving from New York City toward Toronto, it's like an 8-10 hour drive. Every couple of hours, I need to stop, I need to get some coffee, I need to use the restroom, I need to compare Tim Hortons toward Dunkin' Donuts and all of those sorts of things. And you take his rest and you spend some time there. Back in that day, they would go and they would sleep in tents, they would park their camels and their horses, and there would be people who would sell and distribute food and so on and so forth. Amr ibn al-As, he pays somebody in this journey between Kufa and Egypt, and he says, when you see Malik al-Ashtar come with his big contingency of followers and his army and his military personnel, give him this food mixed with this poison so that he's unable to reach Egypt. And in the outskirts of the city of Cairo, we come and we see that Malik al-Ashtar was poisoned and he was killed, and he was never able to act upon the instructions given toward him by Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. But nonetheless, those words of the Commander of the Faithful live forever in reality.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacre of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. She denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel as state-sponsored violence. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Xinhua news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations Human Rights Chief has expressed dismay concerning the brutality with which the Israeli regime is leading its ongoing months-long war of genocide in Gaza. Volker Turk told the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, on Thursday, 29th of February, there appear to be no bounds to and no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred as a result of the Israeli military's onslaught in Gaza. Israel launched its campaign on 7th of October last year, following the Al-Aqsa storm operation, a surprise operation by Gaza's resistance movement against the occupied Palestinian territories. Volker Turk condemned the brutality of the Israeli response as appalling and entirely wrong. Meanwhile, the UN official warned about the pending dire consequences of a ground invasion that the Israeli regime has threatened to stage against the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than 1.5 million of Gaza's 2.4 million plus population have fled to Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, finding nowhere else safe across the coastal sliver. Volker Turk said such a grand assault would contravene the orders issued by the United Nations highest court. On 26th of January, the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, said Israel had to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Genocide Convention. Volker Turk said, "I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice. The prospect of an Israeli ground assault on Rafah would take the nightmare being inflicted on the Palestinians of Gaza into a new dimension." Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. The European Union has wrapped a recent unjustifiable attack by the Israeli occupation forces on Palestinian civilians seeking food aid in the besieged Gaza Strip, calling for an international investigation into the deadly incident. In a statement on Saturday, 2nd of March, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell condemned the restrictions imposed by Israel on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the opening of Gaza's crossing points. He said the firing by Israeli troops on civilians trying to access foodstuff is unjustifiable. Josep Borrell added, "We request an impartial international investigation on this tragic event, allowing for a clear picture of the events and responsibilities." At least 112 people were martyred and more than 750 others were injured on Thursday, 29th of February, as the Israeli military opened fire on Palestinians who had surrounded a convoy of 38 aid trucks in Gaza, with the Palestinian Health Ministry calling the incident a massacre. The latest Israeli crime comes as non-governmental organizations and United Nations experts have on several occasions voiced fears of famine in Gaza. Gaza has been completely cut off from aid by the Israeli regime since October of last year. The European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell emphasized that Israel shoulders responsibility of complying with the rules of international law and to protect the distribution of humanitarian aid to the civilian population of Gaza. The top EU diplomat pointed out the responsibility for this incident lays on the restrictions imposed by the Israeli army and obstructions by violent extremists to the supply of humanitarian aid. Josep Borrell warned that the restrictions on the entry of humanitarian assistance contribute to creating scarcity, hunger and disease, saying it would also lead to a level of desperation that brings about violence. He added, "Unabated fighting and disregard for international humanitarian law will lead to complete chaos, making the distribution of humanitarian aid impossible." Josep Borrell stressed the need to restore a minimum of order and security in Gaza to preserve a humanitarian space. Borrell added, "We urge Israel to fully cooperate with the United Nations agencies and other humanitarian actors involved in the humanitarian response and to allow free, unimpeded and safe humanitarian access through all crossing points in Gaza." The EU's top diplomat also urged Israel to swiftly remove the obstacles at the Kerem Shalom crossing and open the access in the north at Karni and Eretz crossings, to open the port of Ashdod to humanitarian aid and to allow a direct humanitarian corridor from Jordan into Gaza. He emphasized that airdrops should be a solution of last resort, given their minimal impact and their risk to civilians. Borrell also urged the United Nations Security Council to call for an urgent cessation of hostilities in Gaza. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacring of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Ilhan Omar denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel, calling it state-sponsored violence. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar made the statement at a press conference on Thursday, 29th of February, along with other U.S. lawmakers, including Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, as she voiced concerns about the high death toll of Palestinian civilians and the displacement of over 1 million people in the Gaza Strip, criticizing the Biden administration for approving additional aid to Israel without congressional approval. Ilhan Omar said, "This administration cannot claim to be an honest broker of peace while greenlighting the massacring of Palestinians in Gaza. The restocking of Israel's arsenal is not foreign policy, it is state-sponsored violence waged against defenseless families who want only to live in peace." Ilhan Omar stressed, if we truly want to uplift humanity, to protect the innocent people of Gaza, to bring hostages safely home, to hold out hope for peace, then we must demand a ceasefire in Gaza right now.